You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 27th of September 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
Germany's people have spoken. Germany's politicians must now interpret what they said. The UK's opposition Labour Party stages the annual brawl with itself, billed as conference. And why are some countries likelier than others to elect more female parliaments? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Mary Dejewski and Jonathan Fenby will be here to discuss all the day's big stories and the latest installment of our On This Day series. We'll recall the train disaster for which generations of country singers have been grateful. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by the foreign affairs commentator and columnist for The Independent, Mary Dejewski, and by the chairman of China Research and director of European Political Research at TS Lombard, Jonathan Fenby. Hello to you both. Have either of you, I will start with you, Jonathan, been out panic buying lately, as appears to be the order of the day in the United Kingdom once again?
I can't say that I have joined in this, but at the weekend, I was coming back from a walk and I passed a neighbour who was carrying two big shopping bags completely full of toilet paper rolls.
This is amazing. This is a very 2020 thing for people to
yes,
be doing.
I thought she was going back in, you know, back a couple of years. And I said to her, "You're well stocked up, aren't you?" And she said, "You never know."
Well, that's true as far as it goes. And that's probably as far as we want to go with that. Mary, have you been out panic buying lately?
I have not. My sole contribution to non-panic buying was actually to check that my car still starts when I put the key in the lock. It's old enough for a key to be needed to be put in the lock.
You haven't had any ne'er-do-wells out with a siphon where you live or anything yet?
Not that I've noticed, but I did notice to my somewhat regret that the small supermarket on the corner, it had bare shelves yesterday afternoon in a way that it never had right through the heyday of the pandemic. So I don't know whether this was due to distribution problems with lorries, petrol shortages, or whether it was just because everybody had been panic buying.
Well, we will return to an aspect of Britain's continuing crisis later in the show. But first to Germany, where voters went to the polls yesterday and now face an amount of waiting around to see who they elected to govern them. While the votes have been counted, the tribulations of coalition building now await, and they may be even more complicated than usual, likely necessitating three parties. The greatest vote share was won by the centre-leftish Social Democrats. The SPD's leader and probable next Chancellor of Germany, Olaf Scholz, has indicated that he favours a collaboration with the Greens and the business-oriented Free Democrats. Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak is in Berlin covering the election. He's joined now by Thomas Kleiner Brockhoff, Vice President of the German Marshall Fund.
Thanks, Andrew. Yes, I am here at the Berlin office of the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and I'm joined by the director of the office, Thomas Kleiner Brockhoff. Thomas, thank you very much for taking some time today. It was a long night yesterday, so I guess I'll first off ask you the same question that Olaf Scholz was asked this morning. How much sleep did you get?
Oh, a bit. I'm not in that same category as these politicians are, because it seems as if they spent the night already having first conversations about who could work with whom.
First conversations, and those conversations continued this morning. I mean, it is going to be a very tough coalition. But first, I mean, talk about Olaf Scholz a little bit. He spoke English in his press conference this morning, which in itself made quite a change compared to Angela Merkel. I mean, what are your impressions of the man who's now, you know, in the driving seat for the coalition?
Olaf Scholz single-handedly resurrected social democracy that was on the verge of being a dying species. It had a long decline until Olaf Scholz turned things around. Now, that means he owns the party now. He owns the party for a while, because social democrats have a great tradition of criticizing and in the end even firing their own leaders. That was true in two previous governing periods with Gerhard Schröder and with Helmut Schmidt. So there is a bit of a history here. And here, too, we have a very centrist candidate in Olaf Scholz. At the same time, his party is considerably to the left of him, and the new members of the Bundestag of his group are still further to the left. So friction inside the party is ahead, but for now, Olaf Scholz owns it.
Well, frictions in the party that could develop even more as these coalition talks continue. I mean, the Social Democrats hope to form a coalition with the Greens and the Free Democrats. I think many countries would frankly marvel at the fact that such parties can even have a conversation about forming a government together when they're so different. What does that say in itself about the German process?
Wasn't it a great day yesterday? We had a high turnout. We had the fringe parties losing. We had populism seemingly having crested for the second election in a row. The European election was similar, and Germans converging towards the middle. Yes, we're shifting a little to the left, but by and large, everybody is able to talk with everybody else, and there is pragmatism. By the way, there is no election challenges that you can see, even though there were some mishaps, especially in the capital. So it does speak to the middle-of-the-road liberal democratic system and stability that characterizes this country so far.
We have seen some congratulations for Olaf Scholz, particularly from some on the left, the Nordic countries. Many of their prime ministers immediately congratulated him. I mean, what does that say, do you think, about Scholz's approach? You said it's a slight move to the left. Is he going to shake up Germany's role in the world in any way?
He ran on a stability ticket. This was not a change election. In fact, you could say the only party that ran on a change ticket were the Greens. And the reason why they came in where they came in, very disappointing from their perspective, could be that they offered too much of change. Olaf Scholz presented himself as the incumbent and as the heir to Angela Merkel. This was a beauty contest about who seemed more Merkel-esque to the electorate. Therefore, he will approach governing in that spirit, and he has campaigned on it. He has, on the international front, has made it a condition to work with him in a coalition to be stable in foreign policy. And that, to me, was as much a demand from those who want to work with him in coalition building as an intra-party call, because many critics of a stable, Western-oriented increase in defense-type foreign policy come from his own party.
Well, and just maybe a final word on the Conservatives, if I could. They obviously saw a tremendous drop. What does that say in itself about Angela Merkel's legacy, even though you talked about Olaf Scholz being somewhat the heir apparent to that?
Angela Merkel has to take some responsibility for this outcome as well, because she denied her would-be successor the incumbency by remaining in office. A conservative could not go to the polls and have the advantage of incumbency because of her. That taints her legacy, because what happened here for conservatives is pretty much an unmitigated disaster. And now the question is, are they even in a position to form a government, given the recriminations and the soul-searching that is going on and needs to be going on after historic loss? Angela Merkel has been very keen on preserving her own legacy. Yesterday was not a good moment for that preservation effort.
Well, we'll see how it continues, both in the CDU and with Angela Merkel's legacy. Thank you very much. That was Thomas Kleine-Brockhoff. Back to you in the studio, Andrew.
Thanks, Chris. Let's now punt the German election over to our panel, Mary Dajewski and Jonathan Fenby. Mary, you were in Germany until very recently. Did you get any sense that some great change was in the air, at least, you know, relative to the scale of great change and German politics?
I mean, I did get one very strong impression, which was the way the Social Democrats felt that they had the wind behind them. That seemed to me a huge change, both from the very beginning of the campaign, when the SPD thought that they were really, you know, people had predicted that they were in terminal decline. When I went to Scholz's, one of his last rallies in Cologne on Friday, it was one of the best attended rallies I went to at the time I was in Germany, and the sort of mood and the atmosphere, everything was very upbeat. And Scholz came across both in the television debates, in the round tables, and at the rallies as being very much in command and a very credible candidate. Having said all that, you also got the impression that he was going to win by a much bigger margin than he did. And yes, I agree with the chairman of the Marshall Fund that the CDU-CSU did very badly, and that there are a lot of knives out internally now. But actually, Armin Laschet, their candidate, when he appeared before his party and then at the traditional round table on television after the provisional results, he looked like a cat with cream, because he had expected to lose, and he'd expected to lose by a lot, not just by an absolute infinitesimal margin. And that very tiny margin gives him the possibility still of becoming chancellor because of the way the system works. And so, in fact, it seemed to me that at the election post-mortems, it was Scholz who looked rather downcast and rather disappointed, and it was Laschet who'd actually come out rather better.
Jonathan, all of that is true. This is not by any means a done deal yet. If I've done the maths right, there are, broadly speaking, five plausible combinations of coalition, four of which do actually involve the CDU. But Olaf Scholz, who as the leader of the party with the biggest vote share, I think is entitled to be thought of as the presumptive chancellor, has made it fairly clear that he thinks the CDU are long overdue a stint in opposition.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, the Social Democrats should be given their chance to form and be the major force within a new coalition. But as Mary absolutely rightly said just a moment ago, the build-up of momentum for the Social Democrats during the campaign, if you look at the graphs, it is very, very striking indeed. But they didn't really maintain that through the actual election day, the weekend. And that faces them with something of a problem, because they obviously don't want another grand coalition with the CDU-CSU. So now, you know, can they really find enough common ground with the Free Democrats, a very market-oriented liberal economy party? Where do the Greens fit in this? This is a very, very complicated situation, I think, in those tripartite negotiations, which will be going on for weeks, maybe months, with Merkel still there in the Chancellery.
Mary, I was struck looking at a map of Germany with the regional quirks detailed therein. And of course, all countries have those regional quirks, but Germany seemed to be becoming quite stark. There's a big SPD vote in the northeast, broadly speaking, a CDU/CSU vote in the south and west. An alternative for Deutschland, the rather cranky far-right nationalists who nobody is talking about going into coalition with, they only poll 10% nationally, but they're the biggest party in two states in the east.
Yes, I mean, the AfD has actually always been much stronger in the former east than it has in the west. In the west, it's been very much a pariah party, the sort of party that you don't admit to pollsters that you might even consider voting for. Whereas in the east, there's been much more fear and hostility towards migrants. The whole atmosphere, and I think the way that sort of East Germany was organized and the way East Germans were brought up and educated, that there is still a cultural difference between the two parts of Germany. It's lessened a bit, but it'll take another generation at least before it's actually erased.
Jonathan, just finally on Germany, and by way of seamlessly teeing up our next item, is there anything in the apparent triumph of Olaf Scholz and the SPD that other centre-leftish parties elsewhere in Europe could perhaps learn something from, like perhaps, you know, putting people in charge who, while they may be broadly dull, are obviously at least somewhat competent?
Yes, and get a reputation, I think, for competence and stability. I think this election was particularly, as it were, German in its reflection of the post-Merkel period, the uncertainty, the desire for stability and continuity, which the CDU was unable to guarantee, partly because of its candidate, partly because of where he came from, partly because of indeed, Merkel's continuing presence. And so somebody else was wanted. And I don't think that can be replicated really elsewhere.
Well, let us stick with the subject of centre-left European political parties led by slightly dull middle-aged lawyers. The UK's Labour Party is presently putting itself through its annual conference in Brighton. Labour has been led for about 18 months now by Sir Keir Starmer, former head of the Crown Prosecution Service. He finds himself very much not the first occupant of his role to have had no more persistent or pernicious enemy than the left wing of his own party. This time, however, both emboldened and aggrieved by their recent interval of prominence under Jeremy Corbyn, who lost two elections, but none of the lustre with which his acolytes endowed him. Mary, I'll put to you a similar question to the one I just put to Jonathan, but in reverse. You know, should Keir Starmer take any heart from the triumph, not maybe just of Olaf Scholz, still to be confirmed, but obviously President Joe Biden in the United States, again, perhaps not personally terrifically inspiring figure, but somebody who does seem to have some idea what he's doing?
Well, I would answer that sort of on the one hand and on the other hand, because I think on the one hand, yes, I mean, I do see that there is a sort of post-pandemic trend to the left, which is partly because the pandemic has exposed all sorts of problems of inequality, basically, and poverty and unfairness, which plays straight into a left-wing agenda.
It also exposed incompetent governance as well.
That too, but I do think that was actually also a factor in Germany, and it was something that Scholz referred to. But I think the British position is slightly different, and for a completely sort of left field reason, which is that Boris Johnson has actually co-opted an awful lot of the centrist and left policies, especially on the economy, on things like nationalisation, de facto nationalisation, which isn't called that, subsidies, the furlough scheme, all those sort of things. To an extent, he's played politics over the last year further to the left than Keir Starmer has. And Starmer obviously had a problem in moving to the left because of the legacy of Jeremy Corbyn, but Johnson doesn't have that. And I think that puts Boris Johnson in a much stronger position, even if there is a swing to the left in the UK.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, that Starmer has to be careful, because if he does anything that can be accused of, here's Corbynism come back again, that's very bad for him in all kinds of ways. Whereas Johnson can pick and choose with what are basically big state solutions to a number of crises that we're facing in this country.
Where do you think, Jonathan, though, Sir Keir can go looking for votes? I mean, it has always been axiomatic in this country that Labour can only get elected by persuading a thin sliver of the Tory vote to go over the wall. But a lot of what Labour used to rely on, especially Scotland and apparently a lot of the North, is gone. Scotland, you would have to think, more or less permanently. And the North, it will take some recapturing.
Probably quite a long time. A lot of the Red Wall seats in the North are gone for. And so Starmer has to go for the famous old, wavering centre votes, who will vote largely on the economy, the idea of that Labour is actually competent to run the country, which is very important, and the kind of shenanigans that we've had at the Conference of Brighton this week over rules and so on and so on, where Labour appears to be more interested in its internal fights than anything, you know, grander and so on. That doesn't do it any good. But it's also got really to show what it can present as incompetences by the government and particularly by the Prime Minister. I think Starmer will need to get more personal.
On that subject, Mary, we may be 3 years away from another general election. And again, it is also axiomatic in British politics that if you're in opposition, there's no point really in floating huge signature policies at this point, because if they're any good or popular, then the government of the day will just nick them. And if they're unpopular, then either they'll be forgotten or we'll tank your polls even further. So as a general rule, at this point, presumably in an election cycle, what should a leader of the opposition, especially one needing to or seeking to rebuild his party's image, actually be doing?
Well, I think he should have been much, much tougher on Boris Johnson and possibly more personal. But I don't think he actually had to be more personal. I think he had to be more political.
I meant going for the Prime Minister rather than talking about his
personal. I understand. No, I agree with that, absolutely. But I think he's actually failed to grasp some of the political opportunities that he's been given, and that a natural politician would immediately home in on all sorts of faults of a government. And you can watch. I mean, Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland does that very, very well, and I think Keir Starmer doesn't do it. He was an expert and very highly competent and respected lawyer. And the trouble is that when he appears in the Commons, even now there are actually people in the Commons and they're not on screens, nonetheless, he comes across to me as a lawyer first and foremost, and not as a politician. He simply doesn't seem to connect. And I think that's his biggest problem, because whatever Boris Johnson's flaws, and there are many of them, failure to connect isn't one of them. I mean, when he goes off into market squares and talks to people on the street, they can quote back at him what he's said in various of his speeches and utterances, and they see him as one of them, and they've never done that, and I cannot see them doing that with Keir Starmer, which means that if it's a Starmer-Johnson contest the next time around, then it's very difficult to see how Starmer can win.
Yeah, Johnson has got away with it. He's an expert at getting away with
it. That's basically the one-line summation of his entire CV.
And Starmer has to deal with that. And craft, you say there are 3 years to go, he's got to craft a kind of attack mode which will deal with that particular facility, weakness, strength, whatever one wants to call it, of the Prime Minister.
Jonathan Fenby and Mary Dejewski, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from you on the other side of this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear, especially in uncertain times. People seek stability and confidence. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope and with real confidence. Conor Foran is an award-winning designer and the founder of Disfluent magazine, a publication that aims to recognise stammering as a strength and destigmatise it as a weakness. Conor and his colleagues are passionate about recognising disfluency as something to be proud of. Conor, it's great to talk with you. Artistic people have to be confident to make their way in the creative world. Where do you think those who work in the arts get this confidence?
I think a lot of the successful creative people I know wouldn't even consider themselves as confident. But then on the flip side, there are confident creative people who don't have the work that can back it up, I think. But there is a thing that I remember in art college that, like, one of my tutors told me was be relentless. And I mean, I wouldn't even like look at myself as a confident person, really. I mean, which is why this answer might be a bit of a paradox, but there is a thing in that phrase that has helped me kind of understand the nature of confidence and success in the creative world. Of course, being like relentless has its cutoff point, but so does confidence, as like no one can really relate to an overconfident person. But I think the state of being relentless hits a little bit deeper than just wanting to be a confident person. Because I think in a way, being confident is like a lot more than the common trope of just believing in yourself. It's about the struggle. It's about being relentless in the fight against insecurities or like inhibitions that you might have about yourself. And I think there's a thing in the active nature of being relentless that I relate to, that against all the odds, I'm still striving to uncover the truth about myself, maybe, or to prove to myself that I can do or be something. And I think a lot of people will also find confidence out of necessity, in that there's no other option, there's no turning back. And I think that's a thing which I can relate to as well. And I think that's how, I mean, Disfluent was born that way.
Conor Foran on unlocking, building and maintaining confidence today and tomorrow. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our panellists Mary Dajewski and Jonathan Fenby. And let's persist further with what seems to be today's theme of reasonably encouraging news for centre-left liberalism in general. This past weekend, Switzerland voted, and by a thumping margin, to legalise same-sex marriage. It does mean that Switzerland is one of the last countries in Western Europe to get around to this, but they do prefer to think these things properly through. They only awarded the vote to women in 1971. Iceland, meanwhile, almost joined the select coterie of countries with a mostly female parliament. Mary, we looked this up, and there are a very few countries which have mostly or nearly mostly female parliaments. Rwanda, Cuba, New Zealand, Mexico, Nicaragua, and the United Arab Emirates. A couple of those parliaments obviously need a bit of an asterisk next to them, perhaps not, you know, exemplars of deliberative democracy, but do they have really anything outwardly in common?
Well, I looked at that list and it really seemed to me as though it was the most disparate list you could possibly think of. I mean, what
it's
possibly
pretty wild, isn't it?
Cuba and Rwanda, Cuba and Nicaragua, maybe Cuba, Rwanda, UAE, come on. I mean, very, very, very hard to see how they have anything in common. One thing that did occur to me was I did wonder whether any of them had actually quotas for women's representation, which might sort of ring fence it. But other than that, I couldn't see anything in common with them at all.
Jonathan, is there a straightforward answer to the question of what was the deal with Switzerland up until 1971? Not that I'm assuming you're the one person at this table who might actually remember. It's just that by 1971, quite a lot of countries around the world had cracked on with the whole giving the vote to women thing, few of which had descended into Hobbesian anarchy. It had generally been held, I think, to have worked out okay.
Chaos did not generally follow.
Not noticeably, no.
No, and indeed there was one canton in Switzerland, I believe, which held out against the voting, giving votes to women, until 1990 or so. So, you know, there were some hardliners there up in the mountains and so on. No, I think Switzerland is a very conservative place. That's all there is to be drawn, really, from this. And I noticed there was another vote alongside the one on same-sex marriage, which was on some what sounded like fairly minor changes to the tax law, which was turned down overwhelmingly by all the cantons. Progressiveness has its limits.
Mary, in a, what you might think of as a happy ending, though Switzerland did not get around to giving women the vote until 1971, they've made up for lost time a bit in that Switzerland's parliament is now 42% female, as opposed to the United Kingdom's, which is 34%, Australia's, which is 30%, and the United States, which is 27%. Now, those are three countries, the UK, Australia, and the United States, you would think would do better than this, not least because, and I checked, South Australia, when it was still a colony, gave property-owning women the vote in 1861. Gloriously, Victoria, then a colony, gave women the vote by accident in 1863 with a drafting error in the requisite legislation, which meant that women voted in Victoria's election in 1864, after which this grievous mistake was, of course, corrected. But what are the impediments in those three countries, which are three of the countries in the world which make the biggest ballyhoo about being democracies, and yet representation remains that poor?
I think one of them is working hours and working culture. I think that's one of the first ones that, I mean, even though the British Parliament has adapted its working hours supposedly in a more sort of female-friendly way and mother-friendly way, actually it's still very unsocial hours. I think another problem is the way you get nominated to Parliament or to the legislature anywhere, which is that they're very much, in a lot of places, that parties are either not particularly friendly, not particularly female-friendly, or they're very much there in sort of dynasties and closed clubs, and it's actually quite difficult to get an entree without a patron. And I think one of the things that maybe some of those parliaments have in common, where there are more women in parliament, is that there are very strong trade union and local council movements, which are the sort of springboard for a lot of women to get into politics.
Just to follow that up quickly, Mary, do you worry that in the modern context, because this is a thought that occurs to me, that there's a social media penalty to women as well who want to make any kind of career in public life? Because while all politicians get abused on social media, it's hard to avoid noticing that there is a volume and a tone in abuse directed at women which is much, much more obnoxious.
I mean, yes, but I don't share that completely. I tend to think that if you dish it out, you have to take it. And I'm very sorry that the tone against women is so very threatening and so very sexist. And I think there's probably more threats against the actual lives or safety of women on the social media. But I do think there comes a point where you have to say, you know, just look, this is the social media. This is how things work. And if you want to dish it out, then you've got to take it. When it gets to people's lives being threatened, yes, by all means, call the police. But that's not business, really, of social media culture. You can't counsel that sort of thing.
I think it's much more, as Mary was saying a few moments ago, that the nature also of political parties and local political parties, many of which are still want to have a bloke running.
Just a final quick thought on this, Jonathan. When you look at the representation of, say, those countries, and that is pretty poor, a third or lower of the parliaments of those three mighty democracies being women, should efforts be made to go out of their way to increase gender balance? Can you just assume that, look, democracy will figure this out eventually?
I tend to think, yes, democracy will figure it out. It'll be long. I'm sure there's a Churchill quote for this. It'll be long and painful, but it'll come up with the right solution. And I think imposing gender quotas and so on upsets the whole nature of the free choice in society.
Mary? I think there's two big problems with that, because as I saw how it worked in America with affirmative action, what you end up with is a widespread but almost unspoken contempt on the part of a lot of men for some of their female colleagues who they say only been recruited to make up the numbers. And the it leads to a very bad atmosphere. So I'm not convinced with affirmative action at all.
Mary Dejewski and Jonathan Fenby, thank you both for joining us. And finally, on today's show, it is time for another instalment of our irregular historical series on this day, which considers an anniversary noteworthy for some reason or another. And on this day in 1903, a mail train plunged off a bridge and into country music immortality. It wasn't the first train song, and it certainly wasn't the first train crash. But it is the most famous train song of all time, and that in itself has made the wreck of the old 97 on September 27th, 1903, arguably the most famous train crash of all time. Well, it's a mighty rough road from Lynchburg down to Danville on a line with a 3 mile way. It was down that line where he lost his fabrics. You can see what a jump he made. As the song's lyrics tersely recall, the plain facts of the incident are approximately as follows. The Southern Railway mail train left Monroe, Virginia, bound for Spencer, North Carolina, steered by engineer Joseph A. Brody, known to friends, family, and colleagues as Steve. Steve Brody said to his black greasy friend, just shovel on. Brody was under pressure to make up time already lost on the journey and pushed his luck, with terrible consequences. The 10-wheel steam locomotive parted company with the track at a bridge near Danville, Virginia. The mighty engine plunged into a ravine, taking the train down with it. 12 people, including Steve Brody, were killed, another 7 injured. The ballad commemorating the disaster emerged in primordial form in the early 1920s, recorded by blind fiddler G.B. Grayson and singer Henry Whitter. Their song caught the ear of Vernon Dalhart, the Texas cattle herder turned country singer and whistler. Dalhart's 1924 recording is widely acknowledged as the first million-selling country single. It sold, indeed, multiples of that. A standard was consecrated. Legions have since had a lash at the wreck of the old 97, including, but by no means limited to, Hank Snow. And when we cross that wide old mountain, you can watch old 97. Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs. It's a mighty rough road from Lynchburg to Danville and lined on a 3 mile grade. It's on that grade that he lost his air brakes. You see what a jump he made. And Johnny Cash. He was found in the wreck with his hand on the throttle, a scalded to death by the steam. Whose entire vastly influential catalogue is haunted by the song. Cash's signature boom-chicka-boom rhythm pattern, a clear echo of the rattle of iron wheels on rails. Country singers love trains, singing songs about them, setting songs aboard them, and they love them all the better when, like the wreck of the old 97, they are a self-contained morality play of hubris answered by nemesis. It is perhaps telling, however, that the people supposed to draw a lesson from this disaster are not reckless men or their careless bosses, but ungrateful women, as imparted in this instance by Hank Williams III, grandson of a man who surely sang Wreck of the Old 97 at least once. Now all you ladies, you better take a warning from this time on and learn. Never speak harsh words to a true loving husband. He may leave you and never return. Poor boy. Hey, lady. So colossal is the resonance of the wreck of the old 97 that it can be more or less appreciated by now as the foundation stone of an entire sub-genre of country music, the train song, a trope so established that by 2004 Todd Snyder could assume his listeners knew exactly what he meant when he sang this to a clickety-clack backbeat. The train. The train song, the train song, the Playing us out, however, the Texas band that performed the most profound tip of the 10-gallon to the wreck of the old 97, not by merely covering the song, but by naming themselves in its honour. Recorded right here at Midori House back in 2015, here are the old 97s.
Let's drink whiskey into it all night long. Oh, let's get drunk and get it on.
And with that lesson for the ages, that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panellists today, Jonathan Fenby and Mary Dijewski, also to Chris Chermak at the top of the show. The show was produced by Alexa Self and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.